Hey, it was 100 years ago tomorrow, in that it was the 21st of July, 1925. We'll put the memorial from the town of Dayton in Tennessee, just outside the courthouse, up on the screen. I'll read it to you. Here from the 10th of July to the 21st of July, 1925, John Thomas Scopes, a county high school teacher, was tried for teaching that man descended from a lower order of animals in violation of a lately passed state law. William Jennings Bryan assisted the prosecution, Clarence Darrow, Arthur Garfield Hayes, and Dudley Field Malone, the defence. Scopes was convicted. It was called the Scopes Monkey Trial. High school teacher John Scopes was on trial under Tennessee state law. When the verdict was pronounced, he was found guilty of teaching evolution in a government school and was fined $100, $1,800 today's money. That case has been enormously talked about, the Scopes Monkey Trial. The lawyers were heavyweights. Clarence Darrow, one of the United States' most high-profile lawyers of the time and an atheist, he was Scopes' defense counsel. William Bryan, defeated presidential candidate and a Christian, was point man for the prosecution. It was billed as the showdown between creation Bible and evolution science. And for the media, the storyline was creationist stupidity versus evolutionary intelligence. One columnist wrote, on the one side was bigotry, ignorance, hatred, suspicion, every sort of blackness that the human mind was capable of. And on the other side was sense. Now, I'm just putting this out there this morning, because in one form or other, that court case from 100 years ago, I'm feeling a little bit loud, Oliver, if you wouldn't mind just pulling me down there a little bit. In one form or other, that court case and the zillion debates that have followed that have influenced each of us in our thinking on this part of the Bible. And even as I told the story, I don't know which side you will sit emotionally. I know that some in our church, many in our church, have got science degrees. Some are science teachers. Some have postgraduate degrees in science. Some are lecturing in tertiary institutions in science. And perhaps you are one of those people and also a Christian. But over the century, we've seen creation pitted against science, science pitted against creation, and we haven't been able to separate those debates from our examination of these early chapters of the Bible, and I'm going to come to those issues this morning. But first, I want us to read Genesis and read this chapter and the subsequent chapters and try and work out what the author is attempting to assert on his terms. Now, just to get orientated, I want you to know we're going to leave the creation of humanity and the whole men, women, gender, we're going to leave that to next week. But next week and the subsequent weeks, significant things are going to be said about men and women and marriage and singleness, the whole cis-trans debate, sexuality, gender incongruence. But keep coming. In fact, this is a term not to miss a single week of church. Point two on the handout sheet. Verse 1 of the Bible, 7 words in the Hebrew, the foundation sentence for the whole of the rest of the Bible. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. 7 words and 5 points. We're going to do the first verse slowly, and then we will speed up. First thing, in the first word, God. We start with God. In the beginning, God. The word God appears 35 times in the 31 verses of Genesis 1. God is the subject of every verb. God created. In fact, you read verse 3, God said, let there be light. Verse 4, God saw that the light was good. God, verse 5, called the light day. Verse 7, God made the expanse and separated the water. The God who is being spoken of in Genesis 1, in a few chapters' time, we're going to see this God, who's the creator God, is the same God who will promise call Abraham and will give Abraham a land. He is the covenant God of Israel. He is the God who will redeem his people from Egypt, a God who will call them and allow them and give them the promised land. That is this God who is taking the initiative that we are going to see this morning. But just note, this God is not presented here in Genesis 1 as simple mono. See verse 2, the earth was formless and empty. Darkness covered the surface of the watery depths, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the surface of the water. This God that we meet in verse 1 has a spirit in verse 2. And then you look down to verse 26, and in verse 26, then God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Right from the first page of the Bible, there is, if you're looking for it, a hint of more than mono. And in fact, we would say, looking back from this side of Jesus, we would say here on page one of the Bible, in fact in sentences one and two of the Bible, there is a hint of the Trinity. Second thing in this first verse, when we see this God presented and we see God separate over and above his creation, we see Genesis 1 as a polemic against idolatry. For the God that we meet in this first verse of the Bible is spoken of as the creator of the heavens and the earth, and not as a mere idol, part of the heavens and the earth. This God alone creates. And so there is a sharp contrast between this God, the true God, and the false gods of the contemporary world of the ancient Near East, the world of Moses and the other Old Testament. In fact, you look at Jeremiah chapter 10, verse 11. I'll give you the quote. Jeremiah 10, verse 11. You're to say this to them, the gods that did not make the heavens and the earth will perish. These so-called other gods, they aren't the unique creator. They didn't make the heavens and the earth. They will be wiped out. Thirdly, point C, the heavens and the earth. This statement in Genesis 1, God creates the heavens and the earth. God the Creator is not only distinct from everything that he's made, but this thing that he has made is everything. The line heavens and the earth, or the sky and the land, or it's the totality of everything else other than God. Everything is created by God. And then this word created. How did the world, how did the totality of the present order come into being? It was created, made. The very first line of the Bible explains the origin of everything. God created the all that exists in the universe. God alone is eternal. Everything else owes its origin or its existence to God. God's creation is dependent on the creator, the creator. The creation is commanded into existence. There's no room in Genesis for a self-existent universe. The world exists because God has determined that it will exist, and the world continues to exist because God has determined that it will continue to exist. Point E, in the beginning. This created work happened in the beginning. The world has a starting point. And if you've got a starting point, there's a term, a period with duration. You might say in the beginning of the year, or in the beginning of the day, or in the beginning of the hour. What we're talking about is in the beginning of the history of the heaven and the earth. And at the beginning of the history of the heaven and the earth, God creates. We're going to fill this out. This creation work of God under two headings: God, days 1 to 3, forming, and God, days 4 to 6, filling. So point three, God forms and God fills. First 3 days, God forms the earth. Next 3 days, God fills the earth. And we're going to see a structure of days, a flawless, systematic orderliness distributed over the 6 days of work, and then a seventh day set aside for the enjoyment of the completed task. So day one, God forms. Verse two, the earth was formless and empty. Darkness covered the surface of the watery depths, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the surface of the waters. Then God said, let there be light. And there was light. God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. Then there was evening and morning, one day. Just note, God creates by his word. God said. God's only tool in creation is his speech. And God's speech causes the world to be formed exactly to God's thought, right down to every cell and atom. And God does it with such ease. Now, day one, forming, corresponds to day four, filling. So God forms the heavens and the earth, the sky and the land on day one, and God fills it on day four. He creates the sun and the moon, the stars to fill the sky. Verse 14, the God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the sky to separate the day from the night. They will serve as signs for the seasons, for days, for years. There'll be lights in the expanse of the sky to provide light on the earth. And it was so. Now, when you understand, and you'll see this stylistic pattern between forming and filling, day one, day four, day two, day five, day three, day six, you'll see, that's why the sun and the moon are created on the fourth day. Because you would initially think, how do you have a day without a sun? But we're not talking history here. This is poetry. This is an argument that's being presented. But stars, day four, flung into space and set on course. God setting the sun in its galaxy. As Kent Hughes says, the constellations speed away, and God sets them speeding away. The earth and the moon are in place because God commands them to be in place. The natural laws work because God ordains it. The earth is filled with rotating light. Now, day two, God forms. Verse six, God said, let there be an expanse between the waters, separating water from water. God made the expanse, separated the water under the expanse from the water above the expanse, and it was so. God called the expanse sky. Evening came, morning, the second day. Now, Hughes notes, in these verses 6, 7, and 8, the idols, the gods of the earth, of vegetation, the idols, the gods of earth, of fertility, the ancient Near East kind of things, they're powerfully dismissed. There's no sea god here. There's only a sea which is controlled by the ultimate God, the real God, the true God, the existing God. He makes the sea, day two, and then day five, correspondingly, he fills the sea with fowl and fish. Verse 20, then God said, let the water swarm with living creatures. Let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the sky. God created large sea creatures and every living creature that moves and swarms in the water according to their kinds, and every winged creature according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. God blessed them. Be fruitful, multiply, fill the waters of the seas. Let the birds multiply on the earth. Evening, morning, fifth day. Then you get to the third corresponding pair. And day three, God creates dry land. God forms dry land, vegetation. Verse 9, let the water under the sky be gathered into one place. Let the dry land appear. And it was so. God called the dry land earth. and the gathering of the water he called seas. And God saw that it was good. And God said, let the earth produce vegetation, seed bearing plants, and fruit trees on the earth bearing fruit with seed in it according to their kinds. And it was so. The earth produced vegetation, seed bearing plants according to their kinds. The Creator has formed a creation fit for animals and people. And so on the corresponding day six, God fills the land with animals and people. Verse 24, let the earth produce living creatures according to their kinds. Livestock, creatures that crawl, the wildlife of the earth according to their kinds. And it was so. Verse 26, God says, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. They'll rule the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, the livestock, the whole earth, and the creatures that crawl on the earth. God created man in his own image. He created him in the image of God. He created them, male and female. Next week, the whole of our talk next week is going to be on verses 26 and 27, the creation of humanity. But just note the correspondence here between day three and day six. The double repetitions of God said, the double repetitions of it was good, that God knows, this is good. Seven times God says this is good in this chapter. The great artist admires his handiwork. It is good and perfect, for it will accomplish his desires. And we step back from Genesis 1 and say, wow, this is a breathtaking piece of literature. The arrangement, the correspondences, the symmetries. And it is this information here in Genesis 1 that actually gives us a confidence for life. That God the Creator creates a good world in an orderly way, and our world continues to move forward in an orderly way. We take that for granted. We expect our world to function in an orderly way. But you know what? It is only cultures, worldviews, that have been influenced by Genesis 1 that have that presupposition. Other cultures do not operate with that presupposition of orderliness, that presupposition of patterned, of predictable, a pattern of life where we can test things scientifically and get answers that will be the same there tomorrow. Now, we come to the New Testament. Genesis 1, in the beginning, God. Genesis 1, verse 1, created the heavens and the earth. John chapter 1, verse 1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God. Wow, what's happening here? In the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. All things were created through him. And apart from him, not one thing was created that has been created. Genesis 1 starts, in the beginning, God. And John chapter 1, verse 1 unpacks this word God. John shows you that God is also his word. And we saw in Genesis 1 that it is by God's word, God spoke, and a world came into existence, that creation happened. And we see in John 1 that the creating word is Jesus. You look down to John chapter 1, verse 14. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. We observed his glory. The glory is the one and only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. The argument's a little complex. But if you look at John chapter 1, verse 15, and then down to verse 28, I think it's absolutely clear. that the word is Jesus. I still actually remember the chair I was sitting in my lounge room in Annandale in Yonge Street. And it was just before I was married, and it was some time before I was married, but I was reading John 1, and the pennies dropped as I saw, the word is Jesus. Now, what are the implications for us in our contemporary life today? Well, I have six. First one, Genesis 1 is for monotheism and against polytheism. Genesis 1 gives us a single sovereign creator who speaks the universe into being. It is a radical affirmation of monotheism, the belief in one God, over and against the polytheism of ancient Near Eastern and many modern religions. Judaism and Christianity both receive Genesis 1 as authorized authoritative scripture. Islam, in fact, upholds the belief in one creator, which is consistent with Genesis 1. Whereas in contrast, faith systems like Hinduism, Mahayana Buddhism, Confucianism, Taoism, Shintoism, and many indigenous faiths operate on very different assumptions, often involving multiple gods, multiple spirits, or impersonal divine force. Therefore, Genesis 1 calls into question the foundational worldview of those faith systems and affirms the world has one maker, distinct from and sovereign over his creation. Secondly, Genesis 1 rules out dualism. Dualism is the idea that there are two sources of authority. It's kind of a Star Wars theology where you've got the good power and the bad power, the all good God and the all bad God, and these two beings are eternally opposed and in an ongoing cosmic battle between good and evil, both considered supreme, both powerful, both ultimate. Whereas Genesis 1 doesn't see the world like that. There is one God, only one God, creator of everything. No rival God is present in the creation narrative. There is no cosmic tug of war. There's one sovereign Lord speaking creation into being by his will and power. And Satan, while he does exist, he's not ultimate and he's certainly not equal to God. He's a created being, a rebellious creature, not a co-eternal one. And his role in the biblical story is significant but limited. And at Jesus' cross, Satan is defeated decisively. Genesis 1 reminds me, the history of the world is not a battlefield between equal powers. The world is created by one, all-powerful, all-good, unchallenged God. Thirdly, Genesis 1 is against astrology. Astrology claims that the stars and the planets influence human behavior and determine future events. Genesis 1 rules that out. God said, verse 14, let there be lights in the expanse of the sky to mark the seasons, to mark the days, to mark the years. Sun, moon, and stars are created things. Their purpose is to separate day from night, to give light, to mark time, days, months, and seasons. Sun, moon, and stars are clocks and calendars. They are not guides for romance or career. Stars are for light, not to tell you who your boyfriend should be. To use a star to decide who to date, when to travel, which horse will win the Melbourne Cup, is not just unbiblical, it is stupid. We should not be afraid to say clearly, astrology is bunk, crystals are bunk, God rules the universe, not the stars. They don't do that. Genesis 1, fourthly, is against asceticism. Genesis 1 says, God saw all that he had made, verse 31, and it was very good. But asceticism, in an extreme, teaches that the physical world is bad and that holiness means denying yourself as much as possible. Deny yourself food, deny yourself sex, deny yourself pleasure, deny yourself rest. But God's creation is his good gift. Creation is not evil. It's not to be rejected, but it's to be received with thankfulness. So Genesis 1 is against asceticism. So what do I say? Go on holidays. Enjoy them. Go surfing. Enjoy the waves. Drink wine. Enjoy the wine. Don't dishonor God by treating his good creation as if it were bad. Point 5, Genesis 1 is against existentialism. Existentialism says life has no given meaning. We're thrown into a godless universe. We must invent purpose for ourselves. But Genesis 1 says the opposite. In the beginning, God created. Let us make man in our image. We are not accidents. More on this next week. We are not alone. More on this next week. We don't create the universe. We don't create our own essence. We receive our own essence. God makes a world with order, beauty, and intention. He makes us with dignity and purpose. Existentialism says the world is meaningless. Genesis 1 says the world is good. And finally, Genesis 1 is against materialism and accidentalism. Materialism or accidentalism, that's the belief that the physical world is all there is. There's no God, there's no purpose, there's just matter, time, and chance. We're nothing more but slime plus time. So Philip Adams, who I used to work with a long time ago, one of Australia's most outspoken, sorry, just to be clear, when I used to work with him, it wasn't when I was doing Christian ministry, it was when I was working in broadcast journalism, but he's a guy, outspoken atheist, who said, to me, the universe is meaningless. There's no destiny, there's no author of creation. Life is just a brief flash in infinite darkness. But that's not the view of Genesis 1. We're not accidents. We are created by a personal, purposeful God. And that gives our life meaning, morality, dignity. So, tomorrow, on the 100th anniversary of the Scopes verdict and the debate between science and religion, what do we say? Well, a few weeks ago, in preparation for today, I interviewed Dr. Lewis Jones. He's an astrophysicist. I first met him years ago when he came to Australia to do postdoctoral research in astrophysics. But he now has a theology degree as well and leads the Christian ministry to people doing postgraduate degrees in Sydney. And so I asked him, how do you put together these perceived tensions between Bible and science? And he gave me his 15-minute answer, which you can watch by going to the QR code on your handout sheet in the bottom right corner. But then I said, could you give me the 30-second elevator pitch? Because it's got to go at the end of my talk. And he said, okay, just as the information on Google Maps and WhatsApp chats don't contradict, because they're actually telling you different things, so the information between the Bible and science don't contradict, because they're telling you different things. So here's the answer he gave. We'll just play it for you, and then I'll hop up and we'll take questions and comments.
My 30-second elevator pitch is John 20:30. That is, John tells us at the end of his gospel that he could have put a lot of stuff in his story that he told. The things Jesus did could fill many books, but he chose these specific things to include in his account of Jesus' life and ministry in order to persuade you that Jesus is the Christ, or maybe that the Messiah is Jesus, depending on the word order. And so the elevator pitch is the Bible's a book of theology. It is explicitly taught to us from inside of itself. It's constructed.
It's got an interest. It's got a focus.
It's constructed in a way to teach us something about God. Yep. It is not constructed as fundamentally, primarily, a historical book, an account of something. There are historical accounts of things in the Bible. Of course there are. It's not primarily constructed as a scientific handbook for understanding the mechanisms of the world. Does it explain those things? Yeah, sure, it does sometimes. But primarily, by its own admission, in a sense, it is a book of theology trying to teach us something about God.
I mean, we were talking the other about Google Maps versus WhatsApp chats.
Yes.
Do you want to explain that to us?
Yeah. Oh, well, yes. I mean, you know, in a day gone by, you might have thought of a street directory and a phone book as a kind of two different ways of holding information, some overlapping information, because that phone book actually has addresses that correspond to places in the street directory.
Yeah.
But it's different kinds of information, and there's compiled for different purposes. In the same way, Google Maps, I mean, the same sort of idea with the maps, shows us different parts of the world and the streets where we live. But WhatsApp chats is all, you know, the people you're connected with, and you've got a lot, long list of people there. They all live somewhere in Google Maps, as it were. And you might even drop a link from Google Maps into one of your chats because you're going to meet up with those people one day and you want to make sure they all go to the right cafe. And so there's overlapping realities between these two things, but they're not created for the same purpose. And they give us different insights into our lives.
So Lewis Jones says science and the Bible can live together with humility and peace, and I commend his full answer to you to watch, but it's quite a different position to the position of either side in the court case 100 years ago.